The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
You don't want it, you don't need it, but you're gonna get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
Bring Curtis Samuel in the backfield now. Gonna run a little option. Howe, foot in the ground, nice cut. Howe is in! Touchdown, Washington! Here's Howe to throw it, loading up, going deep, and he's got a man! It is caught by McLaurin!
I think those were the two most impressive plays of many. In the season finale last year from Sam Howell in the 26-6 win over the Dallas Cowboys. The 9-yard touchdown read option keeper run where he cut back across the grain into traffic and scored. And then that 52-yard completion to Terry McLaurin deep down the far sideline at the end of the third quarter. He had a couple of really good throws. I went back this weekend and just spent 10 minutes looking through the highlights of that game, of all of Sam Howell's highlights from that game. He had a couple of very good throws in timing to Jahan Dotson, but he was impressive in the game. He really was. I mean, statistically, 11 of 19 for 169 yards, a touchdown, a bad interception where he forced it into an area where there just wasn't any room or any receivers, really. But overall, it was. I know we've gone through this game before, but it was a really good first outing. That was way back in January of this year. On Friday, this was Tim Hasselbeck. Now, you can say whatever you want about Tim Hasselbeck as an NFL quarterback. He wasn't a very good one. I think he had a 0.0 passer rating as a quarterback of the Washington Redskins against the Dallas Cowboys at FedEx Field way back in the Spurrier days. But this is what he was saying about Sam Howell on NFL Live this past Friday.
I will tell you right now, he has the demeanor to be an NFL quarterback, and he certainly has the physical ability. He's not necessarily the biggest guy. He's kind of, you know, a little bit shorter, kind of thicker. At the same time, he can throw it. Like, he has a legitimate talent to throw the football. Yeah. You saw it on Dan's tape. He has plenty of arm strength. He is remarkably accurate. He rushed for 11 touchdowns his last year at North Carolina. I think he is a really, really talented player. So I think between offensive line issues, young wide receivers, things like that towards the end of his career. And then I would also say this, the style of offense, I think sometimes became hard to look at it and say, all right, well, how does that project to the National Football League? Yeah. Like, yes, I get it. Like, the NFL's running RPOs now, but it was different. I thought there were times he got stuck with the football where they're blocking the run and he's waiting for somebody on a route. Mm. I thought that happened too often at North Carolina. I think more traditional offense is going to be something that really is good to him because he has a willingness to play on time, which you have to do in a West Coast offense. And I think that will be the majority of what they do. Will there be RPOs? Absolutely. I mean, everyone should have them in their plan. But I think just playing on time and trusting his ability to be accurate and push the ball to really all areas of the field, I think gives Sam Howell a chance to be a really, really good NFL starter.
Tim Hasselbeck from a few days ago on ESPN. I wanted to start this show with some football and Sam Howell. That comment from Tim Hasselbeck the other day I saw on social media, and that got me to go back and watch some of the Sam Howell game against the Cowboys from back in January. And I have a couple of thoughts on what Tim said and a couple of observations about Sam Howell upon further review. And I know we've reviewed that performance a lot. But before I get to that, let me just mention one guest on the show today, Doug Kammer from Channel 4, the chief meteorologist for News Channel 4, is going to be on with me in our last segment today. Those storms that came through on Saturday night, very destructive. I love that kind of stuff, and I love talking to people who really understand what happened. Doug's going to jump on with me, and he's going to talk about what we had on Saturday night. Was it a tornado? Was it a derecho? Was it just one of these microbursts? So Doug will be on with us. I think, you know, everybody likes weather to a certain degree. Doug also, by the way, is a huge DC sports fan because he grew up here. So we'll talk some Washington football team with Doug as well. But Doug Kammer coming up in the last segment. The show today is brought to you by the Circa Million and the Circa Survivor Pools out in Vegas. They are the biggest and the best at the best hotel and sportsbook in Vegas. There's no sportsbook like the Circa Sportsbook. The Circa Million is pick five games a week against the spread. At the end of the year, the person with the best overall record wins $1 million. It's a $1,000 entry, a maximum of five entries per person, $6 million in guaranteed prizes. So beyond first prize, there are another $5 million worth of prizes out there for the Circa Million this year. The Circa Survivor Pool, look, that's just like any other Survivor Pool. You pick a team every week to win, no point spread. If that team loses or ties, you're out. But if that team wins, you keep going. You can only pick each team once during the season. The Circa Survivor has $8 million guaranteed to the winner or the winners. So that makes the Circa Million and Circa Survivor Pools out in Vegas in total $14 million in guaranteed prizes. No rake, so if the entries go above the guarantee, all the extra money goes to the prize pool. The entries are open until September 9th at 2 p.m. You must register in person at a Circa Sportsbook in Nevada. I will be out there later this week on my way to Wyoming to see Cooley for the weekend. Weekly picks can be made from anywhere through a proxy. The Circa Million and the Circa Survivor Pools out in Vegas. I will let you know how it goes. I'm going to sign up for both of them. And I think Vegas for just two nights makes a lot of sense. And then I have no idea what Cooley's got planned. I talked to him on Friday or Saturday, I forget. And he was upset that I was only going to be there for 2 days. And his reaction was, well, if you're only going to be here for 2 days, which is about half the time I thought you were going to be here, I'm only going to give you half effort when football season starts. To which I said, well, you pretty much only gave us half effort last year. But no, I don't know what he's got planned. I know we're going to do some fishing, which I'm looking forward to. But we will be back next week to talk about it, and I'm sure he will jump on the show at some point next week as well. Remember, Tommy is off. He is off to Spain. He is gone for this entire month. So we won't talk to Tommy again until it would be the first show after Labor Day. It would be a Tuesday. So he'll be back on that Tuesday and Thursday schedule when we get ready for the beginning of the NFL season. So Tim Hasselbeck said a couple of things. You know, he was very impressed with the arm strength, very impressed with just a lot of what he saw from Sam Howe. And he went back to the Carolina thing and tried to explain it. And we've been through that a million times. And he likes him as a fit in the West Coast offense. He likes him certainly as a fit for a lot of RPO, which I think we're going to see a lot of with the Eric Bieniemy Sam Howe combination this year. By the way, Ben Standig was on radio with me this morning, and Ben suggested that it was not the best day for the quarterbacks on Saturday. Now, today may have been a little bit better because they had off Sunday. We'll get to the big crowd on Saturday here momentarily. But there were a couple of things that I jotted down as I went through the Sam Howe, you know, every play from that game back in January. Again, this may be a little bit repetitive, but I can't even remember what I said all the way back in January. So to me, what really, really sticks out is he's got big time arm strength. The throw to Terry McLaurin deep down that far sideline, the 52-yarder, is a beauty. But he makes other throws during the game that show great arm strength on an out pattern to Jahan Dotson. He's got touch passes, too, that are really, really impressive. He doesn't have just, you know, rear back and throw at arm strength. I think he throws with a lot of touch. Now, touch and accuracy are different. You know, throwing those deep balls or throwing those, you know, balls where you've got to fit it in somewhere, there's some touch involved. There's some finesse in the throw involved. I think he's got both. I think he's got really good arm strength, and I think he throws with really good touch. Now, his accuracy, I'm interested to see how consistent that is. In a pro system, in the pro game, week in and week out, if he gets that opportunity, I think it's okay. I think his decision-making actually is more of the issue. But first and foremost, on arm strength and just arm talent, he's got it. He's got touch associated with it for sure. And man, does he have a quick release. When he hit Jahan Dotson on a couple of slants, I mean, one of them's really under pressure, and he's almost on his back foot, and that ball comes out so quickly. With touch and with accuracy on some of those throws. I actually thought those were some of the more impressive throws. Now, the deep shot to Terry and the touchdown run are the two truly, truly memorable plays from the game. But I am excited to watch him throw the football. Accuracy, that's a TBD. Decision making is a big TBD, and was the concern with him at Carolina in that final year, and I think will be the concern to a certain degree from those that really watched him at Carolina at the pro level. But the dude can flat out throw the football. That is not going to be an issue. Now, the mobility thing. I've talked a lot in recent months about how I think he can be a Justin Fields, Jalen Hurts, dual threat kind of quarterback. You know, in watching his runs against the Cowboys, he ended up having in that game, 5 rushes for 35 yards, and he had that 9-yarder for a touchdown. He had a scramble for a first down as well, about a 10-yard scramble. You know, he's not super quick or super fast, at least not in that game. I remember him being a really good runner at North Carolina in that last year, you know, when they were without Javonte Williams and without Michael Carter and without some of the receivers, and they had O-line issues, and yet he carried them as a rusher that year. But he's more of a physical runner. You know, he is stocky. You know, it's kind of what Tim Hasselbeck was talking about. I mean, he is 6'1", but he's 225. He's kind of a boxy build. And I'm, you know, this is not a big reveal, clearly, but in watching, you know, some of the runs, I think he's got good vision. I think he's got good decision making. He's an athlete for sure. But he's not Jalen Hurts. He's not Justin Fields. You know, he's just not at that level in terms of quarterback, rushing ability, quarterback speed and quickness and cutting ability. I think for whatever reason, just thinking about him more at Carolina than in that game against the Cowboys. I was excited about the possibility of him being truly dual threat. And it's funny because I shouldn't have been, because people have told me that that's not what they were expecting at the next level. People who have much greater knowledge, like Phil Longo, the offensive coordinator for North Carolina during those years, now the OC at Wisconsin. But I remember asking Phil when he was on the show, do you see a dual threat quarterback? Do you see a lot of zone read, designed runs incorporated into the offense? And he said he really didn't. We had Brian Simmons on the show. Brian calling Tar Heel games for the Tar Heel Radio Network and was a former scout for the Jacksonville Jaguars. And he said the same thing. He can run and he's really good off schedule, but he didn't see, you know, Sam as kind of a dual threat QB in the NFL. He's not Lamar Jackson. He's not Justin Fields. He's not Jalen Hurts. He's not Daniel Jones, you know, in terms of the true running quarterbacks. He's not as quick. He's not as fast. You know, he's not Kyler Murray. You know, I don't even know what the comp is, because that body type is a little bit different. You know, it's kind of Sam Darnold-esque in terms of his body type. Darnold, by the way, right now is in San Francisco. Remember, he's going to back up Brock Purdy, who has pretty much been given a clean bill of health. I mean, they're really thrilled with his health. That's a lot earlier than I think anybody thought. But Sam Darnold's body type is, to me, the Sam Howell body type. Now, I looked this up. I mean, Darnold's technically 6'3" and Howell's 6'1". But they kind of look the same in terms of their physical stature on the field. And I think they're the same kind of rusher, because Darnold can run the football. I wouldn't have said that necessarily until watching the Dallas runs again. He'll be very good off schedule. You know, he'll be good as but, you know, Taylor Heinicke had really good feel and vision as a runner, and I think was very athletic. I think in many ways really underrated athletically. And again, the single biggest criticism I had of Scott Turner was not leveraging that running ability more. Some of that may have been on Taylor, but I don't even know if Sam's as athletic as Taylor is as a runner. I'm not about to compare the two in terms of who I'd rather see in this upcoming season. But those were the two things that really stood out. Is, man, he's got a gun, and he throws with really good touch, and he's got a really quick release. The accuracy, TBD, for sure. The decision-making, a big TBD. And by the way, decision-making, let's face it, we've all watched enough football. If you're not a good decision-maker as a quarterback, it's, you know, in the NFL, it's not for long. So that's going to have to be an area in which he really improves from where he was in that final year at Carolina without all the weapons, understood. And then as a runner, he's fine, and I think he'll be a, you know, he's certainly not a pure, you know, in the pocket statue guy, but, and no, he's not that at all. He is mobile. He is athletic, but he's just not as quick or fast or decisive with his vision like I have been talking about him recently. So, starting the show with football today. And a little bit on Sam Howell. Look, the first few days of camp were days really about new ownership and about crowds. And I want to talk about that right now. 10,000 at training camp on Saturday. I'm so happy for the players. I'm happy for the coaching staff, too. I mean, look, being in Washington the last 3 years, the Ron Rivera staff, you know, Rivera having been in different places where it meant something, Jack Del Rio having been in different places where it meant something, both of those having a real memory of what it used to mean here. And yet for 3 years, they haven't, you know, coached in that environment. John Allen and Deron Payne and Terry McLaurin, the Ohio State and the Bama guys. I mean, like, this was a joke to them. I mean, they didn't say it because they've got a lot of maturity and class. But, I mean, after you've played in Tuscaloosa and after you've played at night in Death Valley at LSU, and when you've played in the SHU, you know, in Columbus, and you've played, you know, played in games, before 90 to 110,000 fans in big game environments, this had to be a major letdown for them at the pro level. You know, they could have been drafted by Seattle or by Green Bay, you know, by some in played in some of these places where it really, really rocks and it really means something. But they haven't, you know, and obviously the first year for this staff was the pandemic year. But it's not only been, you know, a very sterile environment, it's actually been worse than that because it's been a very negative environment, both, you know, on a day-to-day basis, dealing with all of the stuff, you know, beyond football, and even at the stadium, you know, playing essentially in road environments in your home park. But man, Saturday, this continues the trend for me of being, you know, a bit surprised. I said before a week ago last Thursday that I thought it was going to feel very anticlimactic to a lot of people, and I was dead wrong. 10,000 people at a training camp practice. This is what Ron Rivera said about it.
From us to the fans, we really just appreciate them coming out, and to those that stuck through us through the thick and thin, and you know, we're always there cheering for us. I know there's a lot of other things out there, but just being there for us, I really thank you to them. And having these folks come out the last couple days, thank you for being here. And I'm looking forward to those who've come out. I really do mean that because, you know, the last few years have been hard. They've been trying. But knowing that there are people out there that really do appreciate us, that we really appreciate them. So thank you to the fan base.
I mean, come on. As human beings that have lived the day-to-day of the last, you know, 3 years, certainly the last 24, how can't you be kind of happy for Ron Rivera? A lot of you were really upset last week when I was kind of defending him and holding him up to be one of the few people that could have navigated the 3 years the way he did as a leader. You know, I'm very aware of what the results on the field have been, but I'm happy for him. I'm happy for guys like John Allen and Terry McLaurin and, you know, a guy like Tress Way even. You know, he's been here longer than anybody else. I mean, there were 10,000 people at training camp on Saturday. That is not unusual in many NFL cities, and it was far from unusual way back in the day. Look, I was there in Richmond in 2013 off of that 2012 season. It was insanity with RG3 coming off a playoff season, all in for week one. We did shows from there the entire week. It was crazy, the number of people. And it wasn't 10,000. I think it was 20,000 plus each day that came in through those first few days. It's just nice to kind of see that enthusiasm and that, you know, that excitement back. And I talked a little bit about this on radio this morning. There is, there's a mass response going on right now that this franchise has not enjoyed in a long time. I'm not talking about the niche response, okay? You know, there are, I don't want to compare this, well, I am going to compare it to the Caps hardcore fan base, okay? I think most people understand when the Caps are in the playoffs and they're doing well, it generates a tremendous bandwagon effect. You know, this is a big event town more than it's a hardcore sports town, and there's a bandwagon effect with any of the teams when they start to play well. And we've seen that with the Caps in the springtime so many times over the last, you know, many years, especially the Ovechkin years. But really at the core, you know, there's a much smaller, you know, 25, 35, 40,000, whatever it is, that make up the real hardcore part of the fan base. And by the way, they all go to games. You know, they go to games. But what Washington has seen with their football franchise here in recent years is, you know, kind of a similar hardcore group, you know, a 25,000 to 30,000 group that never gave up, in part because, okay, they're really loyal. That is, you know, a redeeming value in somebody. But let's also call it for what it was, too, which is they were a group that really, as a whole, was a bit naive to what Dan had done to the franchise and what Dan was really doing to them, which was taking advantage of them, which is what he did to all of us for a certain period of time. It's just that many of us, the majority of us, two-thirds of us, figured it out. Now, you know, 25 to 30 to 40,000, I'm talking about the people that went to games. I mean, they had 10,000 at training camp on Saturday. There have been a few home games in the last few years, I'm not talking about pandemic year, where in terms of the fans rooting for the home team, it wasn't that much more than 10,000. But what Saturday and the first 2 days of camp kind of reflected was, you know, there's a mass response going on here again. The numbers at training camp Saturday, this was part relief, this was part joy, and it's a real reflection of what the fan base, past and present, a lot of it is now willing to give the team in terms of a new opportunity. Many that were there on Saturday, and even those who weren't there, are giving the franchise a chance again, a chance to kind of win back their fandom, win back their hearts, win back their spending, win back their wallets. You know, that chance never existed with Dan at the helm, in part because everybody knew that with Dan owning the team, there wasn't a chance for a winning outfit. I mean, and hell, some people weren't even rooting for them to win after a while. I can remember doing a radio segment several years back and asking people how many out there are actually rooting against the team. And a lot of people were. You know, they didn't want any success, even the tiniest success, because they knew it would go right to Dan's head and it would almost embolden him. But now that he's gone, you know, there is this olive branch, this peace offering, if you will. And this honeymoon period, we know, is going to last for a while, okay? That's a given. Because anybody could have bought this team and they were going to get a honeymoon period. And, you know, the ownership group that we have also appears to be, you know, at first blush, humble and competent. We'll see. But there was always going to be a honeymoon period. Those who are excited today aren't going to turn at any point on this group. Or they're not going to have super high expectations of this group anytime soon. The expectations will be dialed back a bit. I mean, again, this is a teardown that they're acquiring. So you got to give it time. But I really believe that after paying $6 billion... and for the last week, publicly talking about kind of the long game, being patient, I think they have been, even themselves, surprised at the level of euphoria. And I think there's an opportunity right now for them to turn this level of excitement into a solid base of fans again. Season ticket holders, people who are going to watch the games, et cetera, corporate sponsors, advertisers, et cetera. Look, it was in the business plan, remember, that Harris put together for his investors, that just Dan being gone was their best customer acquisition strategy. It's like Dan's gone, it's going to result in an immediate uptick in revenue. But I think the last week or so, the reaction has exceeded what that business plan said or what they thought it would be. You know, I can't give you an actual answer, a quantifiable answer, as to what the last week and a half has meant to new revenue for the organization. It's up, and they've talked about it being up. I don't know what that means in because we don't know what the – we've seen it as a comparison to percentage up from a year ago, but percentage up year ago from 2021 when – you know, that was the first year off the pandemic. I mean, it's kind of tricky there. Numbers are up. You're going to hear Mark Ein in the next segment. He was on radio with me, and I'm going to play a couple of cuts from that interview, talk about the Arizona game and what he thinks with respect to whether or not it will be a sellout. But I think the discussion, which is they're all basically speaking the talking points, and I love the fact that they're kind of all on the same page, which is, you know, we're going to be patient, we're going to gather information and data, we're, you know, fact-based and fact-driven in our decision-making, we're going to watch this season play out and learn and observe. The truth is, of course they're going to do it that way because it's too late to do anything. We've talked about that for weeks. They can't start firing everybody a few weeks before they host games at FedEx Field. You know, they're talking long game because it's who they are. I understand that. But it's also their only choice right now. But I think the last week, week and a half, I think they realize that there is an immediate opportunity that exists in a bigger way than anybody out there could have imagined. As I said this on radio this morning, as Tony would say, as in Tony Kornheiser, unbridled optimism. And for that to be sort of harnessed and taken advantage of, this team has to start quickly. They have to start quickly because eventually if it's a 1-4 or 2-5 or 2-6 start, then it's just going to be about what's next. You know, we'll wait and see who they hire to run the football operation, who they hire to be a head coach, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that wait will be on. They've got an opportunity right now that maybe they didn't even anticipate beyond the obvious uptick that would come with Dan being gone. But I think there's a bigger opportunity here. I would say that even the preseason games before we get to the regular season have a chance to really keep the momentum going. And most of you know what I think about preseason. I think it's completely worthless, and to draw any conclusions from the preseason is just foolhardy. But I think maybe these preseason games, the first one in particular against Cleveland on August 11th, we're less than 2 weeks away from that, that could be an influence on season ticket sales, ad deals, corporate sponsorship deals. Imagine if the quarterback, Sam Howell, in two drives against the Browns in Cleveland on August 11th, I think that's a Thursday night or a Friday night, I forget. What if he goes 10 for 12, 130 yards and two touchdowns in two drives? I mean, that will just continue where we are now, this euphoria over Dan being gone, the new ownership group, 10,000 people at training camp on Saturday. The lines to get in were insane. We've seen that before. It's not like it's new. It's just been so long since we've seen it. The beginning of the regular season, the Arizona game, it's really a big, big game for what I'm talking about right here. Not because anybody's going to blame new ownership over anything at any point for a few years, but because they can continue to jump on, pounce on this current state of euphoria. You know, that game is important to turning unbridled optimism into a solid new base of fans and revenue. Can't lose to the Cardinals. I mean, you know, how about this? Okay. They have a great preseason game against Cleveland and then Baltimore, and people are like, whoa, because you know, a lot of fans, they take these preseason games seriously. And, you know, they don't want to see a 27-3 drubbing with Sam Howell throwing three picks. Obviously, that would concern all of us to a certain degree if it's really extreme one way or the other. But imagine he really looks good and the offense looks sharp. And it's like, you know, just snippets, you know, two drives against Cleveland, you know, a quarter and a half or a half against Baltimore. And then in the opener, this lame Cardinals team comes in. I mean, this was set up. This is why I picked in my mock schedule the Cardinals as the opener, because I thought maybe the league will give them a break with new ownership and they won't give them a team that'll bring in their own fans and they'll give them a team that they can beat. How about this on September 10th, 4:30 p.m.? You know, it's a 1 o'clock game. Game's over, and this is the result. Stadium was awesome. New paint, new cushions, new scoreboards, new TVs on the club level. Easy ingress, outgress, egress. And by the way, we just beat the shit out of the Cardinals 27-7. Sam Howell, 3 touchdowns in the first half. We just ran Brian Robinson Jr. in the second half until the clock ran out. I mean, you've got the combination of traffic was easier, much easier. These guys know what they're doing. They're putting the fans first. Oh, by the way, we're 1-0. There's a chance here for them early to really build a base over the next month and a half. They know it too. They'll talk about the slow build. They'll talk about the long game publicly, you know. But in part, the opportunity that exists right now, I don't think they even saw 2 weeks ago. Again, they knew something was coming. Now, I'm not going to be shocked if this team isn't very good, and there will be no reason to hold it against new ownership. They are in a no-lose situation for a while now. But there's an opportunity, and Ron and company are under the gun to kind of deliver a quick start for the first time, because they haven't delivered a quick start at all. It's not his MO as a coach at all, anywhere. 0-4, 1-4, 2-5. Again, not going to be Josh's fault, not going to be Magic's fault, not going to be Mitch's fault, not going to be Mark's fault. And they can point to the long term, but it's going to all be about football in October. And if they're 2-5, we're still excited that Dan's gone and the new group is in. But it's about football and the results. And then the euphoria over Dan being gone starts to wane a little bit. And now we're waiting on the big changes that are coming at the end of the year before pulling the trigger on season ticket packages or even single game tickets. But there's just a chance right now. I think you can hear some of it in my voice because I feel differently than I thought I was going to feel. I'm going to go to that Arizona game. I'm going to that Arizona game. More likely than not as a media member. I will probably go as a fan with maybe a couple of friends or maybe with, you know, 2 of my 3 boys, the ones that are on the East Coast, and that would easily be able to go. I think that Arizona game, I always had this vision when the schedule came out that that was going to be the celebration day for everybody. It was going to be an opportunity, and I hoped that it would be kind of a sellout atmosphere, which I think is 67,000 is capacity, somewhere around there. Mark Ein was on radio with me this morning, and he answered the question as to whether or not the Arizona game will be a sellout. You'll hear what he said when we come back, right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Can you tell us, is the Arizona game going to sell out?
I think it is. I do. I believe it is.
One of the new owners of our Washington football franchise, Mark Ein, who was on radio with me this morning on the Team 980. You can listen to that interview in its entirety by going to theteam980.com or downloading the Odyssey app. Mark was great, very generous with his time, spent 15, 20 minutes with me. You can find that interview if it's not already isolated out in the second hour of the show. Now, Mark, you know, was very clear that there was not a lot he could really discuss as far as the football team goes, but we got some stuff from him, including that answer about the Arizona game. By the way, if you're wondering what capacity is now, it's roughly 67,000. I think it's just over 67,000 and change. At least that's what the capacity was last year. So if they sell out the Arizona game, you're talking about a crowd of somewhere in the neighborhood of 67,000. And it does seem like it's trending in that direction. He seems to think like it seems to think that it will be a sellout. I know Jason Wright has suggested that also in the past. That would be awesome to see that home opener on September 10th sold out with all Washington fans. There was nothing like, you know, I know that we go down memory lane a lot because, let's face it, for 20-something years, that's all we've had. There was just something so exciting about, you know, a Sunday game, going to the stadium and knowing that the stadium was going to be packed and it was going to be an electric atmosphere. It would not surprise me if that's what you get on September 10th. Looking forward to that day. It'll be here before we know it. But Mark was great. I would highly recommend listening to that. That City Open is ongoing right now, his tennis tournament. He owns the Washington Castles and the City Open, and they've got some good players down there. Jessica Pegula is the number one seed on the women's side. Taylor Fritz and Frances Tiafoe are the first, are the top two seeds on the men's side. That's always a great event to go to, and he has really done a great job of resurrecting that event and really tennis in town. So I'm gonna play one other cut from Mark from this morning's interview. It was something that he actually brought up, and I just asked kind of a follow up to it. But he had said that there were some difficult days, long days, in getting this deal done. And I followed up on that, and here's what he said: "You mentioned the hard days. And I can only imagine because of the seller that they weren't the easiest of days. But can you share with us, you know, an example of one of those hard days? Were there times where you thought it wasn't going to happen?"
Oh, yeah. No, you're going to have to wait for the, like, Netflix documentary on that one, Kevin, which will be amazing. But it ain't coming out for a while. No, it's every deal's hard, and this one had a lot of complexity. It had a lot of complexity, and so truly everyone. By the way, when I did the tennis tournament, we had similar really hard moments, and I had Larry Ellison wanting to swoop in and move it to California, and there were moments I thought that wouldn't happen, and everything Josh has done and Mitch, they're always hard. This one definitely was, but at this point, we're not looking backwards. We're looking forwards, and you know, we're just thrilled that it happened. And you know, we talk about the first game. We want to make the first game a great experience for people, and I think they will. I think it's going to be really fantastic.
Yeah, can you imagine what a difficult deal it was to do with Dan Snyder over the last many months, especially given that, you know, he understood that everybody wanted him out so badly. So just the threat of staying gave him the leverage he needed. Again, they came up with the number that he was looking for. God bless them for that, because there just weren't many willing to do that. Like, no one else was willing to do that. Even those days when I was in here, and we now go back months on this, when, you know, I think probably back to January or February when I first started saying, look, I'm pretty sure from what I've heard, it's going to be Josh Harris and it's going to be sooner rather than later. The sooner became much later. And I know that there were moments where the deal could have easily blown up. Look, the $60 million fine for the Mary Jo White investigation, I was told that that got really, really dicey at the end with Dan, you know, really threatening to pull the deal and stay on as owner if he didn't get what he wanted out of it. And it was, I'm sure, not the easiest thing in the world to get through, but they did, and here they are, and all of us are better off for it. Again, Mark was great. You can listen to that interview in its entirety by downloading the Odyssey app or going to theteam980.com. So there was practice today, and there was a news story that came out of practice today. And how about this one? Jamin Davis is in a bit of trouble. Now, to be honest with you, I didn't really remember this story until everybody started writing about it from practice. Well, he wasn't there today because he was in court. He was in court because recently in a 45-mile-per-hour zone, he was traveling 114 miles per hour. That happened back on March 28th. Of 2022. He had previously been caught for going 89 in a 65. That was amended to 84 in a 65, so it got below the 20 miles per hour above the speed limit, which, by the way, is reckless driving in Virginia. How do I know that? Let's just say personal experience. And Rigo's old good friend, Homeless Jerry, who was an attorney in Virginia, got me out of that one. That was many years ago. But Jamin Davis was in court, and I guess basically it goes like this. Initially, they were looking at 30 days. They appealed it, and there was a plea agreement for him to do 8 days in jail, incarcerated. But the judge, after reading the plea agreement today, didn't agree with it. So they're going to reconvene on Thursday. And I guess at that point, we'll find out how many days, potentially in jail, Jamin Davis is going to get. And then, by the way, when he will serve those days. Now, if he ends up serving, you know, 8 days or more than 8 days, you know, it's possible that those days would be served when the season ends, so that he doesn't miss professionally any work, maybe during the bye week. But that's something to take note of, the Jamin Davis situation. I have high expectations for Jamin Davis, and I know that he wasn't healthy and he was recovering from an injury in the offseason, and he's had this to deal with as well. But, you know, just imagine the combination of athleticism out on that field with, you know, what you have in Daron Payne, what you have in Montez Sweat, what we hope Chase Young brings to the table, along with Jamin Davis and Cody Barton, who I think a lot of you are going to be pleasantly surprised with in terms of his speed. And then Emmanuel Forbes, who by all accounts has really looked the part in training camp. So far, a couple of other things to get to before you hear my conversation with Doug Kammerer. Looking forward to that. So there was a pretty big story over the weekend involving the team that I wanted to discuss briefly. And I'm assuming by now that many of you probably know the story because many dozens of you linked me to the story over the weekend on social media and said, Sheehan, does this mean you're back in? I don't think you really understood Don Geronimo's position as it relates to the Commanders broadcast. But no, I'm not back in on anything, nor do I think I want to be back in on any of that anymore. Not to say that I'm above it at all, because I'm not. I loved doing the pregame show for 13 years. I loved being a part of the postgame show for many years, doing Monday Morning Quarterback with Andy Poland for like 8 years or 7 years or whatever it was. You know, in recent years on our own station with Logan Paulson and Craig Hoffman, being a part of the pregame show. It's not our station that has the flagship rights. 980 doesn't have it anymore. Odyssey doesn't have it anymore. iHeart has it. So anyway, I am going to talk about this Don Geronimo story. For those that missed it, Don Geronimo made several disparaging remarks Thursday at the park about WUSA Channel 9's Sharla McBride. Now, Don Geronimo works for Big 100, WBIG-FM, and they are part of iHeartMedia. iHeartMedia and Big 100, they are the flagship station of the Washington Commanders. And that started last year. Remember, about a year and a half ago, they won the bidding to take over as the flagship partner for the team after many, many years of our station, 980, being the flagship partner to the team. I remember at the time, many of you, you know, had suggested, and I think, you know, I was quoted in the paper saying this, and I know that, I mean, I remember having a conversation with Jason Wright and others about this, whatever. We weren't dumped by the team, and I said that at the time. We were outbid for the broadcast rights, outbid by like 2-1. Like, the team did the right thing by accepting the iHeart bid. It was a lot higher than the bid our group made, which was the group that would have involved not just 980 doing the games, but 106.7 The Fan doing the games, and I think maybe even another FM outlet that Odyssey, the company that I work for at the radio station, owns. The team did the right thing by going with iHeart because it was the best money by far. Now, if it had been close, you could have made the case that they should have stayed with us because we're the sports talk stations in town. Big 100 is not a sports talk station. It's more of what they call a guy talk format. And Don Geronimo is one of the hosts of one of their shows. No longer. Get to that in a moment. But that happened, you know, a year and a half ago. So last year was the first year that they had the flagship rights. That means that the games aired on their network. Don Geronimo doesn't call the games. He doesn't host the pregame show. I think he does actually some sort of pregame show, I think, on Big 100 FM. I think it's 100.3 FM. I'm not a big listener to that station, and I'm not a big listener of Don Geronimo, although to be honest with you, I didn't even know he was back on radio until they got the games a year and a half ago. But I am very familiar with Don Geronimo as part of the Don and Mike show for all of those years in the 90s, you know, late 80s, I think. I don't know how long they were on for. I was not a big listener to that show, but I listened enough and I was familiar with them. I always felt Mike O'Mara as part of that duo was very, very talented. And look, Don Geronimo was part of a legendary team with Mike O'Mara. That was a big time show for a long period of time in this market. Well, anyway, he was on the air Thursday and made the following comments about WUSA Channel 9's Sharla McBride, who I guess walked right by where they were doing their radio show. After spotting McBride, Geronimo said during his broadcast, quote, "Hey, look, Barbie's here. Hi, Barbie girl." He later referred to her as, quote, "that chick," closed quote, and also said, quote, "I'm guessing she's a cheerleader," closed quote. He also made some comment about her being tight in some area. You can come to your own conclusions on that one. Well, immediately upon learning about these comments, the Commanders informed Big 100 that Geronimo and his producer, Crash Young, could not broadcast from the facility on Friday, the following day, as had been planned. And then the next day, 100.3, Big fired Don Geronimo. And then they released this statement to the Washington Post that read, quote, after an internal review, Don Geronimo is no longer an employee of WBIG. We take matters of this nature very seriously, and this behavior does not align with our core values, closed quote. That was from iHeartMedia's DC region president, Aaron Hyland. By the way, Sharla McBride weighed in, too, with John Keim on ESPN.com. She said, quote, when I heard the comments made about me on the radio show, I felt incredibly insulted and embarrassed. In my 17 years as a professional journalist, I've never been disrespected in such a blatant manner while trying to do my job. Their words were sexist and misogynistic. No woman should experience this in the workplace, and I appreciate the commander's swift response in handling this matter, closed quote. By the way, the commanders also prohibited the station from airing a previously taped interview with team owner Josh Harris. I assume it was a previously taped interview with Don Geronimo and Josh Harris. So, the deal, by the way, that iHeart signed with the team was 3 years. So last year was the first of a three-year deal. This year will be the second of a three-year deal. The commanders said, we were confident that iHeart would address this swiftly and are pleased that they did, closed quote. So I don't want to get into whether or not what he said rises to the level of a fireable offense in every situation. I don't want to get into that. I am not a big fan, and most of you know this at this point, of kind of just, you know, crossing people off a list because of what they think politically or socially, or maybe they made a statement that wasn't intended, or maybe they just made a mistake. That's just not... it's not part of what I have really embraced over the last few years. I do think that there are many, many settings in that job as an FM guy talk radio show host in which it wouldn't even be thought of in terms of firing him for what he said. If he was in a studio, you know, talking about somebody, not necessarily in the studio in front of them, but somebody that they saw on TV or something like that. I don't want to get into that because the context for this, the response by both the team and the station, I think, was 100% correct. First of all, the team absolutely has to tell that station, sorry, that guy and his producer, the two people that were having this conversation, gone. I don't know if you know this about our franchise, but for several years, we have been scrutinized about the way we've treated women in the past. There have been investigation after investigation into our organization about the way we treated women in the workplace. So those kinds of comments are going to create a headline that we're going to be attached to, and that is a really bad idea, and we can't have it. Can you imagine, by the way, if the team didn't respond that way? Oh, my God, that would have been a horrible start for the new ownership group. So 100% the team did the right thing, and then I think the station did the right thing. And they did the right thing because... you know, one of the things I thought of when I saw this is Cooley used to say about the dudes that got busted for weed in the NFL. He's like, I wouldn't even have a problem with the weed. I would have a problem with how stupid they were that they got caught, because they tell you when they're going to test you. And unless you have a really major substance abuse problem, you know how long it takes to get rid of it from your urine before you test. You could double that up to be safe, and there's no way you should get busted for smoking weed. They tell you the date you're going to be tested. And I remember Cooley explaining that to me, going, if I were the general manager or coach, I'd be concerned about the intelligence of somebody that got busted. And I remember the conversation was in the context of Trent Williams being busted, not once, but twice, for weed and suspended. And that thinking applies here. Like, how thick do you have to be to not know that this team has been literally raked over the coals, justifiably so, for the behavior of their management team and the men in their business towards women going back 23 years? I mean, this organization's toxic workplace culture is going to be the number one example when people talk about toxic workplace environments for women. Like, you can't say what he said, understanding A, the team that you're partnered with, B, the team you're talking about, and C, where you are. On that alone, I would have been like, you got to go. You can't be that dumb. All right, that's it on that. When we come back, Doug Kammerer will jump on with me, and he will explain what happened Saturday night for a lot of us. I was near ground zero in Upper Northwest D.C. That's next, right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This final segment of the show brought to you by MyBookie. Go to MyBookie.com or MyBookie.ag. Use my promo code KevinDC to secure a first deposit bonus of up to $1,000. MyBookie's got all of their preseason NFL prop bets up, all of their week one lines. By the way, this Thursday night, NFL football, the Hall of Fame game, Jets and Browns. Do you know the significance of Jets versus Browns at night? First ever. Actually, you know what? This isn't true. And I learned this the other day from Bob Carpenter, the voice of the Washington Nationals on Masson. Bob Carpenter was on radio with me the other day. Bob has a long history of calling so many sports in so many different cities, but he grew up in St. Louis and started to work in St. Louis. And he told me about the first ever Monday Night Football experiment. 1966, Busch Stadium, the Cardinals and the Bears in a regular season Monday night game. They were experimenting with Monday Night Football in 1966. I had no idea because I thought the first ever Monday night game, Jets and Browns, 1970, September, Keith Jackson, Howard Cosell, and Dandy Don Meredith on the call. Keith Jackson would be replaced a year later by the GIF, Frank Gifford. Anyway, go to mybookie.com or mybookie.ag and use my promo code KevinDC. All right, jumping on the podcast with me right now is Channel 4's Doug Kammerer, the chief meteorologist for Channel 4, and one of my favorite conversations, typically during winter or leading into winter. But my God, what a storm on Saturday. So, you know, I thought actually as this thing came through, I said to my wife, I think that the National Weather Service is going to find that there was, you know, a small F0 or F1 tornado because of the swirling winds at the height of it. And I live in Upper Northwest, and there were gusts that I'm going to say exceeded 70 miles per hour. But I want you, as the true expert, me as the faux expert, I want you to explain what we had here Saturday night.
Yeah, and what we had was that, I mean, that line of storms that, you know, came through, I mean, really just incredible the amount of power that there was. And, you know, we've been talking about it leading up to the three-day event of extreme heat. And I said, watch out on Saturday. You know, Saturday could be a day where we have severe weather, because anytime you get this hot, you need something really strong to break the heat. And that's exactly what we got, because we knew Sunday, yesterday, was a much better day temperature-wise out there. But what we saw on Saturday was really kind of amazing, almost derecho-like. And what I mean by that is it's not the same as a derecho because it didn't have the longevity that a derecho had, but it had similar winds. You know, the derecho, we had the strongest wind I saw in the derecho was 86 miles an hour in Reston. That was in 2012. This storm had winds of 84 miles an hour in Georgetown. So this storm came down, and not only did it come, it came right through downtown. I mean, this was really incredible. I was watching this on my phone, on my weather apps that I have, and I'm looking at this wind, and I'm like, this is incredible, about to go right through downtown. And sure enough, we had those 80-mile-per-hour winds. So this is what's called a downburst or a microburst. And what that is as the storm comes through, you have the intense heat. That intense heat is rising into the atmosphere. In order to evacuate some of that air, it goes all the way up into the atmosphere to 40, 50,000 feet, where, of course, it's much, much colder. That air is sitting up there and eventually releases that cold air, because that warm air becomes very cold once it goes all the way up into that cloud. That cold air then races down. Cold air is very dense. So it actually sinks. Cold air sinks. You ever go to your basement, your basement's always colder because cold air sinks. That cold air begins to sink, and it sinks in almost like a bubble. So as it's sinking down, it then races towards the ground and picks up speed. And once it hits the ground, it releases, and then you can actually see it. You can see it on radar. You can see it if you're looking at a storm from a long distance. It releases and sends out this wind in all directions, mostly propagated in the direction the storm is going. So the storm is going to the east, as these were. Most of that is forced off to the east. You get a little back to the west as well, but most of that is forced off to the east ahead of that storm. So definitely different than a tornado. This was not a tornado. This was a microburst or a downburst, and that's what we get here from time to time. Most of our severe thunderstorms have downbursts. We get those, but this was particularly strong because of the fact that we had such extreme heat and conditions were really ripe for some nasty storms.
Doug, how hard, you know, compared to like a derecho, you can see it. I mean, I know in 2012 it was a little bit different, but now derechos can actually be forecasted. Tornado activity, where they will form, et cetera, I know is hard. But are downbursts and then microbursts? Microburst says to me in a very concentrated area versus a wider area.
Right.
How hard are they to forecast?
Well, we knew that was going to happen. You know, that was something that we were waiting for during the day. We said that there could be big downbursts, big microbursts. And that's something that maybe I will use that terminology a little bit more. Before 2012, we didn't really use the word derecho very often.
Right.
Not that it wasn't there before, but because people didn't understand that word. So it's very hard for me. I want to go on the air, and I want people to understand what I'm saying. I don't want to get them with my 2.5-3 minutes of weather, and somebody get off the turn the channel off or go to commercial break, and they're, what's he talking about with a downburst? I don't understand what that means.
Sure.
So what I'm saying, when I get on the air, I'm saying, hey, expect to see strong winds. We could see winds of 70 miles per hour with these storms as they come on through. And that's what we were talking about the day before this event. These were definitely downbursts, definitely microbursts. And we saw those 84 mile per hour winds. So they were definitely predicted out ahead of this with that line that we knew would develop. But it was all about, where exactly is it going to happen? You never know. I mean, I'm in Bethesda. And I had some bad weather. I mean, it was nasty here, you know, terrible weather for sure. But it was nothing like what they saw just 3 miles away from me.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I was, just 3 miles away from you. And it was, I mean, it was, trees were bending to near the ground. And, you know, it took me forever just to get out of my neighborhood on Saturday night and Sunday morning and with the amount of trees that were down. And it is amazing to me, by the way, we live in, you know, in a very tree mature area. You know, not every major metropolitan area has these long standing trees, but man, when you have something like this, it's incredibly dangerous.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these trees that we have, I mean, some of them are, 100, 150 years old. I mean, they're ready. They're ready to go, as beautiful as they are. You know, these are old, mature trees that have many of them have some form of rot inside them, some of their limbs or inside the base itself. And that's why these go up. So many other times, you look at some of these trees that went down, and they're sitting, their root ball is not big enough to support the tree. And what do I mean by that? Well, that root ball, the roots of the tree, have been cut to put in the road, have been cut for the sidewalk. So if so many of these are you continue to see, I see the pictures of this from the other day and from every event that we have. You see the trees come down, and it brings up the whole root ball between the sidewalk and the road.
Right.
There's only 3 feet in most locations that have that. So you have this huge tree between a sidewalk and a road, and it just does not have enough roots. So when that wind comes up, it just can't support them. If they had their normal root ball, which would be out, 10 feet from the storm, it might be, or from the tree, it might be able to support that much wind, but not with wind like this and a smaller root ball.
84 miles per hour in Georgetown, and you said in 2012, 86 miles per hour.
Yeah.
What is the highest gust ever recorded in the D.C. area? I would assume it's associated with something tropical, right?
No, I wouldn't assume that at all.
Okay.
We do not get tropical winds that strong. We have never seen, a Category 3 hurricane come through our area.
But I'm talking about gusts, not sustained. I'm talking about gusts.
Right. But even gusts, we don't get that.
Okay.
We don't get that from tropical systems. So we're going to get that from a derecho-like system. So we've probably had winds, I'm going to say, up to 100 miles per hour. I think I can remember a 96 in there somewhere. I don't remember where and when, but that's about the threshold for us. So we could get anywhere between 80, possibly up to 100 miles an hour with the extreme events. But you talk about an extreme event, as Saturday was, as the derecho was, and we saw those stay below that 90 mile per hour wind gust threshold. Yeah.
What about like when we've gotten, I always think about La Plata. For some reason, La Plata's been like ground zero for tornadoes in the past. And I know that they weren't, massive tornadoes, but what were some of those winds at? And I know that that's not considered to be the true metro area, but I'm just curious, a nearby tornado, what would La Plata have registered?
So we had La Plata. La Plata was an F4. I mean, that was one of the biggest tornadoes in Maryland history. Yeah. So that one had winds approaching, I don't quote me exactly, but probably between 180, 200 miles
Jesus,
per hour. And then you talk about the EF3 that hit College Park a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
That EF3 was going to have winds of over 130, 140 miles per hour. So tornadoes are a different breed. Tornadoes are much smaller. I mean, even the word micro means small, but still a microburst is going to be miles long, where a tornado in our area, I'll give you the La Plata tornado, which had half mile range on it. But even that, a huge monster tornado, an F4, I mean, my goodness gracious, that's one of the biggest you can get. And it had half a mile wide damage path, where a microburst could have a damage path of 5 miles, 6 miles.
Interesting.
So, and then that continues to propagate. So, and it's going to go farther. So if you saw that tornado, most of the time, you don't have long track tornadoes in our area.
Right.
The La Plata tornado was a long track tornado, actually hit La Plata and all the way across the bay. But with the microburst situation, we actually had that from DC and really from Montgomery County all the way to Ocean City. I mean, that's how far that was. So this was almost, I don't think we can, and we'll go back and look at it to see just how far this lasted, how long this lasted, how far it took. Because if it went over 240 miles and we had those types of winds, 70 to 80 miles per hour, they might classify that as a derecho later after some more looking at this, which wouldn't take long.
All right. The intense heat, by the way, last week, I mean, the heat index reached numbers that were they close to record or record numbers that we had on Friday and Saturday?
Not even close.
Okay. So tell me what our heat index record is.
Good question. That one I do not know. I know our heat record, we got up to 106 degrees. That's the highest in D.C. we ever had. And we did not hit. I mean, the highest D.C. has seen so far this year was 96.
Yeah.
So we did not even hit. I believe we did see a 111 at the airport. Don't quote me on that just yet. I think they're still looking at that one. But I saw most of the time at the airport was 106 to 109. That is just below excessive heat criteria. So we had excessive heat warnings.
Yeah, we did.
But we did not hit it. We did not hit the criteria at the airport.
Man, I'll tell you what.
Now, other places have. You know, what have we seen? We've had heat indices that are upwards of 113, 114.
Yeah.
That's about as high as we go in our area. And let's hope we don't go, you know, let's hope we don't go any warmer.
All right. So what's the rest of the summer look like? I mean, this is going to be a nice week comparatively to last week.
Oh.
Are we going to get another?
It's going to be great.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll tell you, my summer forecast is absolutely kicking butt right now. My summer forecast was for lower than average 90-degree days. My summer forecast was for not much extreme heat. I did not think we would see 100 degrees. So far, so good. And when my summer forecast, it's not just our area. I look at the whole country, really all of North America, and I really get that pattern down. And you look at other areas that are extremely hot. You know, Phoenix, for example, setting all-time records. Well, my analog year, you're going to love this one because I know you're going to know where this is going.
I do.
My analog year for the heat this summer and for the summer forecast was 2009.
Oof.
The summer of 2009 was go ahead. Go ahead. I'm going to let you continue.
Well, it's the greatest winter of my life, 2009-2010.
The greatest winter of our lives.
Yeah, so are we going to get a 2009-2010 repeat? We're literally
right
at my house for the winter in Bethesda, yeah, and that's where I was living at the time. I think we ended up with over 80 inches of snow for the winter.
Yeah, incredible, right? Absolutely incredible, including back-to-back blizzards,
in
two
February.
Blizzards within 4 days.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just something that you do not see very often. And, of course, that was it. I mean, the airport, D.C. airport, received 56 inches of snow that summer or that winter. But, yes, areas just outside picked up over 80 inches of snow. I mean, it really is amazing how much snow we saw. And if you follow my summer forecast and this continues, it's all about where El Nino is going to go and how El Nino is developing right now. But everything so far fits. Everything fits. Like I said, Phoenix right now is having their summit. July was the hottest month they've ever seen. The hottest month. Well, guess the fourth hottest. 2009. July of 2009. Dallas, Texas. I called my brother in May when I made my summer forecast and I said, hey, buddy, get ready. It's going to be extremely hot down there this summer. And Dallas is seeing some of the heat. By the way, their highest heat index ever recorded was this summer at 117. Florida, Miami, one of the hottest summers. And that all correlates with 2009. So you look at 2009, also hurricane season was not a big hurricane season, as I predicted.
You nailed your winter forecast last year. I was hoping you were going to be wrong. You nailed it. Now you've nailed the summer. So, I mean, now the percent chance that this ends up being one of your favorite winter season forecasts of all time. Do you feel really confident that this is going to be a stormy, snowy winter coming up?
As of right now, I do. They just had something else I just saw come out today. The European, which, you know, you love the European,
yeah,
just as much as I do. The European came out with a seasonal forecast for the winter and also said that it would be cold and snowy. And it got one of the people that I really look up to in the weather community that does this research on winters in our area, and especially into New England. When he posts something that says how excited he is,
is that Paul?
It,
is that Paul Kosin?
Stuff.
Is that Paul Kosin?
No. This is, and now you got me. I had his name in there a minute ago, and now it's gone.
All right, it's fine.
But yeah, he posted something about that today, and he posted the European outlook, and there's other outlooks that would corroborate that. So I'm super excited right now. Once again, we have to wait and see how El Nino develops. I don't want it to get too strong. The stronger El Nino gets, the worse our snow chances are. I want it to be a moderate El Nino, not a strong or a super strong event.
Yeah.
And right now, it's looking pretty good for that.
Going back to 2009-2010, for those of you that remember, we had a blizzard in December, a week before Christmas, and then we had two of them in February. And we had other, you know, events as well. In fact, we had, I think, an early December event that year, too. Of the three biggies, though, what was your favorite?
I was in Philadelphia at the time. Okay. And I've got to say, you know, the one that really got me, Philadelphia in that December storm, saw the most snow they ever saw in a snowstorm, 28 inches of snow. I was up there for that storm, forecasting that storm. And then the second storms in February, I was out live for 16 hours straight in each of those blizzards, back to back. I believe it was a Saturday and a Tuesday. And I was live for those 16 hours out in the field covering this. And everybody's like, you were outside 16 hours and there's 50, 60 mile an hour winds and snow's coming down. And I was like, yes, I was. And it was awesome. You know, I was loving every minute of it. So I'll never forget that winter for sure, because it was definitely one for the history books.
Yeah, the one in December was kind of exciting because it came prior to, you know, to it was a holiday week, even though by the time we got to Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, the temperatures mm-hmm. had warmed up and a lot of it had melted, but still a lot of it was on the ground. The second one in February, which really only produced, I think, about a foot here, was the most awesome to watch because that was true blizzard conditions for an extended period of time. You know, we had the heavy snow and the wind criteria, and it was just awesome to watch that. You know, I think we had blizzard warnings for all three of those events, but I don't know that we reached blizzard conditions for all three of those. But for that third one, even though it ended up being the least amount of total snow for our area, it was the most awesome for about a three-hour period in the middle of it. It was just... It was amazing because I think we had, you know, 35 miles sustained, which I think is the requirement, right, for a blizzard. Is that it?
Yep. Yep. You have 35 mile an hour for 3 hours. Yep.
Yeah, and the heavy snow, and it was just amazing. Not to mention it was snow on top of snow at that point, which
was crazy.
So, you know, look, the event Saturday night was interesting, which is why I called you, but I am so happy about the result of this conversation. And now I'm going to be bugging you between now and November when you put out your winter forecast.
Yeah. Absolutely.
This would be awesome. By the way, do you see that being timed up so that we get it early, or do you think it's more of a late winter thing?
That's something I would have to check out, but if this pattern continues the way that I think it will, I mean, it could be very, very similar to 2009, 2010. And in regards to, because the amazing thing about this in my seasonal forecasting is I really am able to say, okay, well, this is what happened in July and this is what happened in August. And with the storms, hey, watch out for the third to fourth week of January, that kind of thing. So with this one, it would be watch out around Christmas time. So if this was my forecast and I was making it today for the winter, and of course, as you said, I don't do this until November because I want to make sure I have all my data.
Yeah.
But if I was saying that, I would say watch out around Christmas. Christmas has a much better chance this year of being a white Christmas with the potential for a big storm, and watch out again in early February. That's what I would be saying today if I was making this forecast.
You know what we need? We need that blocking. We need that negative NAO. We need that negative AO. We need the cold getting funneled in. We need the storm track riding up the coast and just off of it.
We need the negative PNA on the western coast. We need the jet stream to go up towards Alaska, in through parts of British Columbia, dive, bring that cold air all the way down to the south, and then ride up the east coast and not allow that storm to go out to sea. That's where the negative NAO comes into place. You've got your 50-50 low, which holds it in. So, yes, that we need all of those things. And like I said, that tweet that I saw earlier today with the Europeans pattern, that's exactly what the Euro is saying, a lot of blocking going on.
God, that is music to our ears. Remember, when you're on the air, you may want to steer clear of NAO, AO, and PNA talk. Because that may sail over the heads of many, even though I will understand exactly what you're saying, because I am a total weather idiot and nerd. All right, speaking of what Doug's interested in, Doug is very interested in the sports teams in this town because he's from here. So an incredible, you know, last week and a half with the sale going through with 10,000 people estimated at training camp practice. Yeah. So What have been your feelings the last, you know, week and a half?
It's amazing to actually have hope.
Yeah.
We have not had that. You know, we really have not had that at all. I mean, every single year it's like, okay, what's going on this year? And a couple years ago we got a new coach, and a couple years ago we got we got a new quarterback. Alex Smith is coming in. All right, great. We got somebody who's great. And they just, that organization just killed any hope that you had as quick as you got it. And I think this time there really is some hope. I think this time there really is somebody at the helm who I know is going to do what is necessary to become a winning team. You know, I've got friends in the Philadelphia area and the sports arena up there, and I talked to them about the owner and what we can expect from Josh Harris, and they said, hey, he does what it takes. I mean, you got to remember, everybody knows trust the process, right? For the Sixers, trust the process. And he was part of that process, and he's a big part of that process. So now it's like for the Commanders, or whatever we're going to be called, it is now trust the process. And we can do that now. Now we can trust the process because now we know we actually have one. It's not going to be something where, you know, Snyder's just making phone calls and telling them, this is the guy we're taking and this is what we're doing. And, you know, now we learn that he wasn't even in the film room and looking at everything, and then he's still telling which guys to pick. I mean, I'm just so excited about the process. I have hope for the future of our franchise. And to your point, 10,000 people coming out to training camp, putting up the bleachers the way that they did for the fans, giving that more of a fan experience. I mean, you know, day one, they're starting on the right path.
So when you said whatever they're called, do you have a preference?
Yeah. I honestly, I don't mind Washington Football Team.
Yeah.
And that's something I hear about a lot. You know, do I like Commanders? Not really. Do I like Major Tutty? Not really. Do I want something? You know, I think about all those guys who have tattoos on their arms that are HTTR.
Yeah.
You know, and I would love to see something so that history, and that we can continue to say, hey, we still have the burgundy and gold. You know, that's what I would love to see. You know, I love Major Tutty. Great, they made it a hog. I get it. I had to look up what the heck Tutty meant, and you know, now I got that. So I'm like, okay, that's at least they, you know, tried to do something. But yeah, I would really like to see if they could do it. I wouldn't mind something with it to stay in the R team, whether it's Red Wings, Red. I don't know. I actually don't mind Washington Football Team.
Yeah, I think that that's the one, other than the, you know, Redskins, which I still don't think will happen, although I think there's more momentum for it than I even thought that there would be at this point. But I think Washington being the brand would be the next most satisfying to the largest group of fans, both past and present, where, you know, Washington's the brand. They the old uniforms are back. You know, if they want to go with the W on the helmet, I'm okay with that. And then people can call them, like soccer fans do, their own nickname, the Skins, the Hogs, whatever it is. But we get away from, you know, what really it seemed like to me, and I've described it this way many times, Doug, I felt like when February 2nd, 2022, I felt like an expansion team landed in my city. And I think a lot of people,
exactly right.
I think a lot of people felt that way. And, you know, the Washington thing was a little clunky and it was interim, but I think actually there was something to Washington being the brand.
Right.
And focusing around that. But we'll see.
And you know what would take that one step further? Our stadium in downtown Washington.
Of course.
Our stadium where RFK is.
No,
you know, I love the momentum there, too, because you don't just see it from the team. You see it from the mayor. You see it from Congress all of a sudden. Like, all of a sudden, the doors have opened for us.
Yeah.
And, again, I'll say to have hope that we can get a stadium built in the city.
Okay, right now, last question for Doug Kammer from Channel 4. You get to choose only one, a stadium in downtown D.C. or a repeat of the 2009-2010 winter in the upcoming December through February timeframe.
Oh, God. Oh, boy. Oh, that's a tough one.
Imagine your ratings if it's just one storm after another. You will personally benefit from that.
That would be my Super Bowl, as it was in 2009, 2010. So, yes, you're saying to me, do I want to go back to my Super Bowl as far as storms are concerned, or would I rather have a great stadium and the energy that that would bring to downtown? I just think that would be an amazing thing. I would love to take my son to those games. I would love to take the, you know, the, for the fans to be able to go into the stadium. So I will take that.
Okay. Well, good for you. You didn't go for you didn't go for short-term gratification over life of memories with your son at the new stadium down on the RFK
100%,
site.
100%.
Let's just hope we can get both. Let's just hope we get both.
I will take both. I'll take a 2016 again where we got one major blizzard.
God,
that's all I need. Just give me one.
Do you know what? I think January 2016 and January 1996 may be my two favorites of all time. January 96 was so great because it was so brutally cold heading into it. So every single flake that dropped stuck. And by the way, it was an extended period of time. Remember, it was like there was a bit of a lull. It started on Saturday night, then there was a little bit of a lull on Sunday, and then Sunday night and Monday morning, that came back as that thing exploded and wrapped around. That was, but you know, it's also one of my favorite Bob Ryan nights of all time. Bob Ryan, of course, the legendary Channel 4. Doug's creating quite the legend of his own, but Bob Ryan,
absolutely,
forever. He came on the air the Friday night, so it was a 1-3 for, you know, on Thursday and Friday during the day, and then the late information, GFS, everything started coming in, the NAM on late Friday night, and he came on at 11 o'clock, and he said, this forecast has changed dramatically, get ready, this is going to be measured in feet of snow. And then we had to build up all day Saturday. And I remember Maryland was playing North Carolina at Kohl Fieldhouse, and it was a big game. They lost at the buzzer in overtime. It started at about 9 o'clock, and it didn't end until Monday morning. That was a great storm. What is your favorite blizzard of all time?
I'm going to say Superstorm of 93 for us. So I would put Superstorm of 93 along with 2016 because 2016 was so one good. That, again, this was one, my winter forecast. I said in late October on WTOP, I said, I'm super excited about this winter forecast. My son was 8 years old at the time. The previous storm, my analog year for 2016 was 1983. That year we saw a major blizzard. I was 8 years old at the time, and I'll never forget
February.
My dad literally throwing me into 2 feet of snow.
Yeah.
So I said on the air, I cannot wait till late January and I think we're going to have a storm that I'm going to be able to throw my 8-year old son into 2 feet of snow. And we got it. And I was so excited about that storm because I had predicted it, you know, months in advance. I knew it was coming. And when we did finally get it, it was just an incredible amount of snow. It was so much fun to watch. I had so much fun with my kids in that storm. So I'm definitely going to go with that one. The biggest disappointment from that storm in 2016 was the total snowfall at the airport, because the snow total blew away. I know, but it doesn't. That storm is number two, probably number two all time.
Well, I mean,
as far as how much snow we've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it goes down as number five or six.
We had 3 feet just north and west of the metro area. I mean, it was a solid two to 2.5 feet at my house.
Yeah.
I love that storm too. I ignore the DCA stuff now. I mean, I think everybody, even the casual weather observer, understands that Reagan National has numbers that don't make any sense compared to what they're seeing in their backyard.
Completely.
Will they ever fix that? I know it's a heat island, but yeah.
Right, I don't think so. And the reason that they won't and the reason that they can't is because of the way that we take observations down there, because we have to have somebody on site in order to clear the board, and that's where they have somebody on site every day at the airport. So it's already built in. So that's why they have it there. But yeah, I mean, it's terrible. The board, the snowboard, and again, you catch snow on the board and you take the snow off there
right.
every 6 hours, you measure it. Well, they went out to try to measure that storm and the board blew away. So they have a 6 hour period where they reported snow that they do not have accumulation for. So, and then you go to the White House. The White House had 23 inches of snow.
Right.
So the White House is right across the river.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So how can we have that same? There were 25, 26 inch totals, five miles. Mount Vernon, I think, had one. Alexandria was pretty darn close to that. And they kept 17.6 at the airport. That's just, ugh. That's where the records are kept. So that's why I'm upset.
I know. I mean, I understand that if you live south and east of the city or in the city, that sometimes those numbers are far different than those that have, lived sort of in the northern and western portions of the area. But for me, I've always looked at the Dulles numbers as a comparable for what the area got. Now, let me just the 93 Superstorm, which I think set records for the lowest barometric pressure for a winter storm. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
I don't know if that was here, but yes.
And I think the size of the storm, we've never seen anything like that.
Now, no, we have not.
The problem with the storm here is that it turned to sleet. We had a long period of sleet, and we did not end up having the forecasted accumulations of like 2 to 3 feet like we ended up getting in 2016 or in 96 or any of the storms in 2009, 2010. By the way, that 83 storm is the first time I ever heard thunder snow. I didn't even know it existed, but we had we had major thunder snow during that February of 83 storm, which was good. The problem with that storm is it was like 70 degrees 3 days later. So it was just, terrible. But you and I could talk about this forever. We won't bore everybody any longer, but let's just get Doug's on the record. The 2023-2024 upcoming winter, all of the analog years support that this could be a big-time winter. And we have not had winter in a few years. I mean, we just haven't. I mean, what was our last legitimate snowstorm?
It was 2016. We did have one in 2019.
Yeah, that was a long-duration one.
Winters have been terrible.
Yeah.
And then 2019, we had at least a good storm. I think we ended up with 13 inches that winter, which is just below average. But we have not had a really good winter. And even 2016 was a one and done.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
It was not a snowy winter at all. That was one and done. So I would like to see a couple of storms. I'd like to see a couple of big storms, and I would like to be able to, have my Super Bowl in regards to snowfall this winter.
All right. It's always fun to have you on either the radio show or the podcast. At Doug Kammer on Twitter. Watch Doug, obviously at 4, 5, 6, and 11 NBC 4. He does such a great job. I will talk to you soon. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it.
All right, that is it for the show today. Thanks to Doug. I'm back tomorrow.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.